Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The Athletic.
MotoGP 2024's European season is about to begin with the Spanish Grand Prix at Jerez this coming weekend. But what does that actually mean in the 2020s? And more importantly, for the purposes of this episode of the Race MotoGP podcast, who is in most trouble coming into that European swing? I'm Matt Beer. I'm joined by Simon Patterson and Val Harunchi as usual. Now, for me, the start of the European season always used to mean a bit of the randomness calms down a bit and then Marc Marquez starts running away with the championship. That's not going to happen this year. Well, I suspect both elements aren't going to happen this year. But, you know, is the start of the European season anything more these days than a kind of handy media stop-off point to draw some conclusions after the first few? Or does it actually mean something for the teams as well, Simon?
It's a chance to get back into a bit of a comfort zone more than anything else. I know we've already had one race in Portimao, but that was kind of because of when it fell on the calendar, a bit of a blip. This is a chance this weekend to get into a rhythm, to be living out of your own space again, to have your own hospitality units and your own truck and your locker and your space and, you know, the sort of the regular team around you that don't necessarily do all the overseas races, all the flyaways. You can see already just from looking at our schedule for this weekend that's starting to come out, how much media activity there is, how many extra events there are, because all those people who won't necessarily go to Qatar or Austin in particular have things lined up for this weekend. They've got activities. So it's both going to be a busy weekend for the teams, but it also comes with like a sense of normalcy that's been missing probably since because Valencia is not a very normal European race because it's the season finale either. It's probably the most regular race weekend we've had since like September last year.
Yeah, since Misano time possibly. For you it means, well, not quite yet, but you're about to start living in a van for the next few months as well.
Yep, back on the road, back into the routine of one weekend off, at least in MotoGP terms, although there's a mountain of other stuff to fill in between as well, between superbikes and road racing and the new Women's World Championship. And yeah, there's a lot on over the next few months, but it's good. It's good to get into that routine of being in Europe.
Yeah, listeners, you can't see the backgrounds in the video that we're recording together on, but this will be the last time for a while I see Simon's house in the background of his screen, I suspect.
Absolutely.
And for me and Val, the main difference is Val has less of an excuse to go to bed at crazy late times. And as the man who does the rotors for most of the race, I've got less complicated time zones to factor in, but my life doesn't really change because I've got two kids under five, so my sleeping patterns have got not a lot to do with racing, to be honest. So I've given these guys a task for this week, which is to pick the riders or teams or other who they feel are in most trouble coming into this part of the season. Because really, if you're behind in the championship already, if you're not making a good impression at this point as contracts are coming together, you've really got to get going when you're back on kind of more familiar soil through the kind of France, Spain, lots of Spain, Italy part of the season. I've asked you both to come up with a list so you can agree slash disagree with each other and to give a little rating on everyone you pick in terms of how much trouble they're in on a scale where one means actually not that much trouble, probably by Mugello at the start of June, this will be fine, and five means kind of give up on 2024, stop setting your alarm, look forward to 2025 or even 2027 and the new rules. So as usual with this sort of episode, I've got my large wooden dice to decide who goes first. Simon, do you consider yourself more odd or more even philosophically?
Even. Odd emotionally, but you know.
I'm sure everyone would agree with that.
That makes me odd, which I mean, fair enough. But,
yeah, well, yeah. It's a big one. So Val, you go first. Who is your first nomination for someone in MotoGP in most trouble heading into the European season?
Yeah, it'll be the Honda Racing Corporation and a firm, very comfortable, very easy 5 out of 5 for a manufacturer that has had a horrendous start to the season, especially at a track where it won last year against all odds. I remember, you know, just thinking a few months back, the idea that, oh, you know, Honda's rebuilding and Mark's coming back soon because the bike's on the right path. That I don't even remember what my mindset was back then. That scenario no longer plays out in my head in any way because the bike is not good. It's basically whatever it improved has not offset all of its goodness that it lost, and there was clearly some good in it. Again, Alex Rins won last year. Yes, Pekka Bagnaia had to crash out of a big lead for that to happen, but Alex Rins was dragging it onto the podium. We think if Marc Marquez was fit that weekend, he would have been right up there too. This year, obviously, they didn't have Rins or Marquez, but you know, Joan Mir, Johan Zarco, they're not scrubs. And they were completely nowhere all weekend. The bike was getting crashed all the time. I mean, only Luca Marini made it to the finish in either of the races. And he was lost by a lot in the sprint. And he was lost in the race after fighting Alex Marquez, who had crashed his Ducati earlier. So even in fighting in a crashed bike, he couldn't quite salvage a point. It's not really working right now for any of them, meaningfully. The only honor there, at least they used to be fighting for the Japanese Cup to start the season in Qatar, but it was just the Honda Cup in Portimao and Kota, two tracks that they expected to be better. And somebody pointed this out, and I do remember thinking it and then immediately forgetting it because there's so much going on in MotoGP. But it is kind of this Honda thing again of the bike looks good in like Qatar and through preseason, and then it shows up to a wider variety of tracks and it just completely falls apart. Remember when we thought that Honda had brought a good bike for Paul Espargaró to finally exploit himself?
Oh, yeah.
And it looked good through the preseason, and he looked so good one round in Qatar where did he lead a bunch of the race on the Honda, I think, and finished ahead of Mark and basically just had Mark covered all weekend, and then came nowhere near that for the rest of the weekend, for the rest of the year, for the rest of the season. And we're kind of, are we on that same path again? Where, except the high point of Qatar was just fine. It wasn't anything special. It was mostly the riders were positive about it because they thought better tracks were to come. But what if Qatar was the better tracks? Then the season's just, I mean, for now it's a write-off until something new comes. And you have to see how big the steps are that they can actually make, because it's not like they've made big steps recently at all.
Thinking back to that question you asked at the start, Val, about what your, can't remember what your mindset even was when you thought Honda might be doing okay. I think this is a question of two tests last year, because we had the Misano test in September, which was so unpromising that Marc Marquez was like, I'm on the phone to Gresini, this is done. And then we had the Valencia test when the feedback was like, actually, there's good stuff coming. This is okay. This is more promising. Maybe Marquez will be back soon. Maybe he shouldn't have even left. And then when the real season started this year, like you say, this isn't just bad. This is so bad. This is so hideously, painfully, almost comically bad. For what was it? Did every Honda apart from Marini crash in both races?
Well, Zarco's Honda failed.
Failed. Yeah.
If that's better,
it's
I
not.
Guess.
It's not actually better, yeah. Is it? Like, and we're having sessions where it's four Hondas at the bottom. We're having, well, any session or any race, you see Marini is last by himself. That just feels like standard now. This is so bad. Some listeners may wonder, is this actually Honda paying the price for losing Marquez as well? Is it, has it got a bunch of riders who are riding a bike not designed for them, and is it missing someone who could have hauled this bike somewhere? But I know Marquez is better than the riders Honda now has, but I don't think he's that much better that he'd be, you know, is even Marquez getting this bike into Q2 at the moment?
I think that actually the good Honda benchmark at the minute is Luca Marini, because he's the guy that's riding the bike as quick as you can ride it without falling off it.
Yeah.
But that's not a bad thing. Like that is, we are now, you know, in theory, given last year's results and then this year's results, I would call Coda rock bottom.
Yeah.
There's not really anywhere else for this project to go in terms of getting worse. They were essentially the last four bikes in every session. They had two finishes out of eight starts. It doesn't get any worse than where they were at Coda. I don't think they scored a point either.
No.
No. So it doesn't get any worse than this. That, you know what I mean? It just can't. But we knew that this was going to be a rebuilding year. We knew that this was going to be a year where they needed to work, where they needed to gather data, where they needed to put together a stronger package. And while I think one of the other people that we're going to talk about on this list, you know, we predicted would take a little bit less time to get back to where they needed to be, I think that there, you know, was there ever really an expectation that Honda were going to fix it in this season? I don't think there was ever, you know, even with that little bit of glimmer of hope from the Valencia test, it was still obvious then that they had done something better, but they hadn't got onto the, you know, onto the right path. Or they'd got onto the right path, but they hadn't got to the end of the journey. I think the bike that we saw at Valencia was a sign that they finally accepted the direction they need to go in, but they're essentially at the beginning of that direction now. There still is a lot of work to go. And for me, yeah, they need to turn it around, but I'm not surprised with how the turning around process has gone so far.
The reason I'm like, I know I didn't expect them to be fighting for wins or even podiums this season, especially because they've lost Mark. You know, to answer your question, Matt, I think it is possible that Mark would have dragged it to Q2 in some places, but it would have required a tow.
Yeah.
He would have been riding behind somebody else to do it, in which case he could have qualified absolutely anywhere, because I think when that Honda follows somebody, especially in Mark's hands, like any lap time's possible. That was sort of, that's just a weird quirk of the bike and the ability of Marc Marquez himself. And I think that quirk has stayed, because the only good Honda qualifying performance this season we've had was Johann Zarco in Qatar. And he towed somebody to make that happen. It's just, the hardest part is the final, you know, couple of tenths, two, three tenths. This should be the easier part, arguably. And it's not happening right now. This is the only bike that we saw in COTA where really, I think you tangibly had the obvious question of, is it actually better in lap time than the predecessor? I mean, Yamaha you could also ask, but in Honda in particular, and I think if you look at the track evolution, you could make a very good case that no, it is not. It is considerably worse around COTA, but maybe also just in general. It's probably got a bit more grip. It's probably offers a bit more feedback. It didn't sound like riders were confused about crashing, which was often the case last year. It just sounded like they couldn't accept the pace that it was giving them, and they threw it down the road repeatedly. It's heavier, I think, not in the kilogram sense, but in the riding sense. As Jean Mir described it, it's lighter in terms of kilograms. They've shaved off some weight, but maybe because of the extra aero, maybe because of whatever, it's just not as agile. They couldn't exploit that at all at COTA, which obviously didn't help.
You phrased it in your column that you wrote about Honda. It's lighter yet feels heavier, which,
yeah.
And I think the way you described it with the aero having that effect makes sense. Yeah, we've talked a few times about these two Japanese manufacturers, Honda and Yamaha, engineering in new problems while trying to fix another one and having that effect of making it worse again.
I mean, it's also worth noting that that's exactly the complaint that the Aprilia guys started the season with as well in terms of their new aero. So that's not something that's unique to Honda, but it is it's an effect of suddenly throwing a ton of aero at the bike, which is something that they've finally done for the first time, whereas everyone else did it years ago.
So I think I'm definitely going to agree with your assessment, Val, that Honda is a 5 out of 5 for trouble, and we're not going to see this situation change much anytime in the near future. The best I can see it getting for Honda is a few more of its riders accept Marini's strategy and just go, let's not break this bike or ourselves, and trundle around relatively and just get the data so it can get back to some degree of respectability. It says a lot, you know, Honda's had this massive livery change for this year. And every time I see a picture of it, I'm like, oh yeah, that's what it looks like now. Because I feel like I see it so rarely. And when I do see it, it's got pieces missing. So I can't even see the color scheme.
Zarco's gorgeous, gorgeous LCR is barely getting any screen time unless it's broken. That's not right. It's not good.
No, completely. I would say MotoGP TV direction is not the best for showing bikes further down the field, but it's not going this far down the field, even if it was.
So the tale of MotoGP's TV direction, the related tale of it not being the best, is one of the retirements was because Joan Mir got hit by somebody and then crashed on the damaged bike that was already damaged. We haven't really figured out who he was hit by. There was contact. You can see, like, if you Zapruder it, you can see the moments leading up to the contact, maybe, but you have to, like, it's at 144 pixels at that point, or whatever 144p means, and yeah, that's not great. It is not great that, like, you listen to riders afterwards and you just discover entirely new incidents that never came up.
That's not what you expect in 2024 in the top level of world championship racing in this genre of things that move. Simon, who is your first pick for someone in massive trouble, and what's their 1 to 5 score?
So I only had two 5 scores on my list, and Val took one of them, and which I'm fine with. I kind of expected that the first pick would go to Honda either way. Yeah. That's not really a surprise. So my number 5 pick, my remaining number 5 pick is Jack Miller, who is just in a world of hurt at KTM at the minute. I mean, it would be bad that he was performing, that he was being as outperformed as much as he is by Brad Binder at the best of times. But the fact that Brad Binder is only the second KTM to rookie Pedro Acosta this season just makes where Miller is right now look even worse. I mean, it's completely lost on that bike. And when he's not lost and when things are working, he's doing the same Jack Miller rookie mistakes that he's done since he made his MotoGP debut. I mean, Sunday's race with at Coda with a semi-decent qualifying position turned into a semi-decent start. You know, it was inevitable what was going to happen by half distance, that he would burn out his tires and drop back through the grid like a stone. He scraped 13th at the end. That's just not good enough. It was even referenced pre-season by team boss Francesco Guidotti, who said that Jack needed to behave better this year, specifically meaning he needed to manage his tires better, and he needed to, you know, to try and improve that factor of his riding, which is something that Miller admitted to us whenever we asked him about it at the Lucille test. But we haven't seen any sign of it. So simply put, whenever you've got a rider who knows where their weakness is, but who can't improve on that weakness week after week, season after season, their time in MotoGP has to be limited. Their luck has to run out eventually. You get the impression that Jack has got so far because he's Jack Miller, the loud-spoken Australian on the grid who's good for TV. But, I mean, he hasn't even got that factor anymore whenever you've got Pedro Acosta. He is literally inferior to the rookie in every sense of his presence in the grid. You know, I've advocated time and again that KTM should switch the mids, which has now picked up enough steam that someone has actually went and asked KTM if they were going to do it, which KTM have said, no, they're not, which, given KTM's track record of rider management, means they probably are going to do it because they're really, really bad at managing riders in that sense. I don't see a way out of this for Miller because he's had 10 years to find a way out of it and still hasn't done it.
Yeah, it was a good friend of the pod, Marcus from Motorsport Magazine, who asked Pit Byrer. I hope I'm not giving the wrong credit here because that would be awful, but I think so. And he asked, and Pit Byrer said, no, we're absolutely not thinking about it, but also said, but contractually we can. Like, there's no, contractually, absolutely we can do it. I don't think they'll do it, but I think it's not even a question for 2025 now. Like, that's not even up for debate. I really don't agree with the assessment that Jack Miller has hung around because he's, you know, a character and outspoken and etc. I think he's been good enough to stick around. He's been fast enough to stick around. Maybe right now he has a better gig than his performance warrants, I think. But that hasn't always been the case at all. sometimes riders are just what they are, apparently. And I think, I do not think we'll see a MotoGP future in which Jack Miller takes really good pace late into races. And for some teams in MotoGP, that might be fine. For instance, I don't see any reason for KTM not to give him a Tech 3 gig for next year in a straight swap and keep him around and keep him working on the bike and keep him delivering some really good qualifying results sometimes. But in terms of the across the comparison specifically, it's been completely one-way traffic, and the way Acosta has completely upended the pecking order at KTM, there's no real excuses to be made. There's no real explanations to be had. Only reason I didn't have Miller on my list here is because we already talked about him a bit in the previous pod, but I would have included him otherwise, obviously, with a 4 or a 5, depending on what we're looking for him. In terms of hanging on to his KTM Works ride, I don't think it's physically possible. I don't think there's anything he can do. Like, just anything at all. I think, honestly, even if he cures the late race thing tomorrow, like, just shows up and becomes an Ea Bastianini, doesn't matter. You're done. It's over. The kid has come in, and his ceiling is astronomical. And sometimes, you know, unstoppable force, and unfortunately, you're just not an immovable object. I think he's still got a lot to offer in MotoGP. I think they should probably just swap the seats next year. It's weird to be talking about that in April, but well, that's modern KTM right now.
For what it's worth, I think he has far, far more to offer World Superbikes than he does MotoGP in the future. Yeah. I think he would be a better addition to that paddock than you know, another year in the Gresini or in the Gas bike in MotoGP, whenever there's names in Moto2 that I think I'd rather see step up to it.
Yeah, I do feel, I think I feel a bit more sympathy for Miller still at this point, because to me, most of his career in MotoGP was looking decent. He was doing the right things through the Pramac stages and even before that, to even before MotoGP, in fact, and how he handled that Moto3 to MotoGP jump, whether he should have done it or not, he handled it pretty well, I would say. And it's just the factory Ducati stint doesn't work out as you hope. But it doesn't work out terribly. It's just Pecco Bagnaia handles that better. And then Miller slips into the support role, does that reasonably well, takes it on very willingly, which I respect a lot. KTM really hasn't worked. The Acosta thing has really, really smashed that now. I still, you know, this guy's won MotoGP races, and he's won them very impressively. He's got a lot of talent. The late race thing is unfortunate, and it's also dramatic. There's times when I look at the timing screen, and I genuinely laugh or get shocked to see this guy who 2 minutes ago was in fifth place is now in 13th. The tumbles are so dramatic when the pace goes. But I think, as much as I've still probably got a little more faith in him than you two, and particularly Simon, has, that World Superbike argument is pretty compelling, because he has had enough time in MotoGP now to achieve what I think he's going to achieve in MotoGP. He's got some Grand Prix wins that he fully deserves. He is not going to pull off a whole championship winning season. Probably it is time to head somewhere else, because he's had long enough both to make a decent contribution to MotoGP, to be able to say he was a very successful, I'd say, MotoGP rider, because there's a tier that's not champion, and he's been very strong within that tier. But yeah,
at the very, very worst, I think he definitely should not be putting anything more than a 1 year deal in MotoGP, simply because, you know, at the end of 25, we're going to have to be having a serious conversation about where KTM are going to put David Alonso.
True.
I mean, there's already that level of talent coming up through the ranks that they've already, you know, they've caught themselves in this trap before of overcommitting to talent and then suddenly having to scramble to find a place for it. We spent the whole middle section of last season writing about what they do to solve their Pedro Acosta, Paul Espargaro problem, which they eventually rather crudely solved by sacking someone that they'd claimed had been, you know, they'd been loyal to for years, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They threw him under a bus. They would be, there's a good opportunity for them to make themselves look foolish and rather mean once again if they sign Miller in a contract that's longer than 1 year.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Okay, Val, your turn again. Who is your second pick for somebody in a lot of trouble, and what's their score?
I mean, let's make this quick because this is another five, and I don't think one that there's really much to say about. Augusto Fernandez obviously is in a lot of trouble. It's just not fast enough right now, and he knows it, and everybody knows it, and that's the situation. He's very openly, very loudly admirable over the job Pedro Costa is doing on the other side of the garage, but you know, he's also not comparing well to Brad or Jack. He's clearly just not vibed with the carbon chassis so far, to the point where it's been floated as a possibility that he might go to the other version of the chassis in the Jerez test just to see what's up. But again, clearly KTM knows what chassis it prefers going forward, and you have to be quick on that chassis. The carbon one, apparently, you know, it's smoother. It's softer, you have to be smoother with it. And it's not really been working for him much. He said he might just try to completely copy across the setup in Jerez if it hasn't sorted itself out by then. He says he's been making some progress. Yeah, because he was really far off in the preseason. He's not quite that far off right now. But in modern MotoGP, those figures, you know, like 1.5 seconds or 8 tenths, to me, that's the same number, if that makes any sense. Neither of those are sustainable long-term. Yeah, I'm a huge admirer. I think at his peak, he's an excellent rider. We've seen that in Moto2, and we've seen that in moments in MotoGP last year. But we've also seen, sort of in his career, especially through his Moto2 career, years that just didn't go right from the beginning and never really sorted themselves out. Particularly, I think his Marc Vidia stint. It's been suboptimal, and for all of, you know, KTM's obvious desire to show outward loyalty as much as it can. You know, you watch Sergio Garcia win on his 23rd or 20 whatever start in Moto2 last weekend, the weekend before, and he just, you know, there is going to be room here for somebody else if that's how it continues. For me, that's simple as.
I'm a little bit more forgiving of Augusto. Simply because I think we what we saw last year was a bit closer to his, you know, we saw decent results from him last year with the occasional very good result, and I think that's his ceiling. And he's not a Pedro Acosta, he's not a MotoGP winner, and I get that there isn't necessarily room for all of those people within every team. You know, that you need everyone to be at a certain level, but not everyone can be. And I think that there has to be a bit of a realization that he is very, very good. He's a world champion in Moto2, but he's not going to be a MotoGP superstar the same way that you know, that some of the others are, and that's okay. It then depends entirely on how mercenary KTM want to be, how much they want to chase a young star coming up through the ranks. But I think given that there's no one else who kind of naturally falls into the KTM progression ladder for next season, that he might not be in as much trouble as you know, he necessarily looks like in paper. I mean, they're not going to get rid of him to promote, say, Jake Dixon.
Yeah.
Who's already in that feeder program, or a really disappointing Celestino Vietti from the IO bike. So I think he's actually got a little bit of leeway because of that. There's no natural successor to him right now, and that should work in his favor.
I see that. I think just for me, the argument is you can be slow enough to where it doesn't matter. And I think there is enough self-awareness in Agusto to know that he's in really close to that danger zone right now. And, you know, you use the word mercenary for KTM, but if this level of performance continues for the season, there is nothing mercenary in not offering him a new contract. He knows that. Everybody knows that. I don't want to be harsh, because he is one of the most self-aware and honest riders on the grid, and you feel bad dragging him through the coals because he already does that to himself when it's warranted. But, I mean, that's how we see things. That's what's going on track right now. Again, best of luck to him. I hope he sorts it out, but... I struggle to remember also a MotoGP season that started like this and then became something decent at some point. That's also my other reservation.
Yeah, I can see that scenario where he ends up being kept just because of the particular timing of what else is going on in the KTM program. But it's a very weird way to hang on to your ride at a time when your performance isn't justifying it. And like you say, it's sad. He's handling this with such grace. You know, he is only 26 himself, which is older than Acosta, but, you know, not old.
Yeah, only does not apply here in the MotoGP context. That's not an only age for MotoGP. That's a geriatric age by MotoGP for sophomore standards.
True. I'm thinking in terms of humans.
Yeah.
But yeah. Put it another way. He's a guy who was Moto2 champion only a year and a bit ago. And for someone who has been the champion of the main feeder category that recently, to kind of hold his hands up and go, this kid is better than me, which is effectively what's happening with Fernandez this year. That actually takes, like say, self-awareness and actually quite a lot of guts to do that. Was Fernandez ultimately one of these Moto2 champions who was never going to hit the superstar bracket? You see it in Moto2 and other kind of second tier series elsewhere in motorsport, where someone takes 3, 4, 5 years to win that title. Doesn't mean they're a bad rider or driver, but they haven't got that superstar trajectory that someone who comes in, smashes it in the first year, moves on has. Is that too harsh on Fernandez? Or
I don't think it's too hard, but I don't think he's I don't think he's like an experience merchant so much as he's just very peaky. That's, for me, that's really more of the Augusto Fernandez experience, I would argue. But yeah, I mean, it was like any world title is a good title, and you can't win Moto2 if you're bad. He wasn't bad. He had a good season on a very good bike, obviously, and a very good team. But Pedro Acosta was his teammate then, and, you know, clearly, given the way Pedro Acosta is now making look seasoned MotoGP veterans on Works KTMs, clearly it is no given to beat Pedro Acosta on the same bike when, you know, even if you have the experience edge. So that counts for a lot, but... yeah, you're probably right in your assessment.
Simon, who have you got next on your list?
So it will come as no surprise that the number four scored position on my list goes to Yamaha, who are not in the same dark pit that I think Honda are in by a long, long stretch, but certainly still have work to do that is not going as fast as we had necessarily hoped. I mean... it is going fast enough to have retained Fabio Quartararo, which is the number one hurdle that they needed to achieve early in this season. They needed to sign him first of all. And the fact that they've done that, it takes pressure off, but at the same time, it shouldn't take any pressure off. it shouldn't mean that they take their eye off the ball on the bigger picture, which is fixing the bike, just because they've got his name in place for the next two seasons. And I would imagine that he is putting a lot of pressure internally to make sure that that's the case. It sounds like there's progress coming in the next few weeks. They have a lot of testing planned. They have a lot of new parts supposedly planned. We get a little bit of a sneak preview of those at Portimao. Even though their private one-day test was cancelled because of the weather after they did like five laps. Fabio, being his usual subtle self, posted a picture on Instagram of a really radically different looking bike that really leans heavily on what Aprilia have done with, in terms of aero. So there's work coming. They are doing things. But they're, you know, I think their biggest challenge is going to be keeping the pressure on now that it would be easy to lose focus a little bit because that deal signed.
Yeah, I had a four for Yamaha too. I'm really very surprised by the initial signs of just how much the new bike, which is to say the new bike they have right now, not the new bike that they will have at some point, seems to be chewing up the tires.
Yeah.
So it's sort of, it's still bad over one lap, but now it also doesn't go the race distance. So best of both worlds, you would say. It's just, right now, it's just not a bike to where there's much of anything to like about it. And it's as simple as that. So it's not doing anything. It's not, one of the Honda riders said about their bike that they don't really have an advantage anywhere. I mean, the same applies to the Yamaha right now, I think. And the grace for them is indeed that they've re-signed Quartararo. I also, the way I did it is I sort of did a cheaty joint entry because I also put Alex Rins down there with like a one because I don't think he's quite, but it's only been three rounds, but I don't think he's quite fully gelled with the bike entirely the way he would have liked to yet by now. I really would like to know if the leg break is still giving him a bit of trouble in terms of performance that he doesn't feel, because he says it isn't. He just says he doesn't walk right, but once he's on the bike, it's fine. Sounds great. But I think we probably do see that sometimes with sportsmen where they don't really understand that it still hampers them a little bit just by being there. And he's been worse affected than Quartararo in particular when it comes to the tire chewing. So it's been a relatively difficult start to the season for him. I think he's, you know, compare him to Morbidelli specifically, it's almost been sort of performance copy-paste, I would argue. But he's obviously got a lot more of a runway in terms of how much he's going to learn the bike and adapt to it and build it around his preferences. So ultimately, he's going to be fine.
Yeah, I think, to be honest,
they probably will re-sign him. But so, I think he has struggled a little bit.
Yeah, I've been disappointed with Rins, but every time I've felt disappointed, I've then gone, well, actually, we don't know about the leg situation. That was a savage injury. He's learning another new bike. And he's, you make the Frankie Morbidelli comparison, but, you know, Morbidelli basically paralleled Quartararo through Yamaha. It wasn't like there was an experience deficit at any point. Yes. They were teammates in both teams for so long. Yeah, Rins has got he's got something very different to make up to. It's not just he's learning the Yamaha. He's learning the Yamaha while being compared to someone who really, really knows that Yamaha, because it's Yamaha bikes have been their entire MotoGP career. I said to you guys pre-COTA that I was putting cheeky fake money on a Rins podium. I think I started out saying win, then realized I was talking absolute nonsense. And then when he appeared in seventh on the first lap of the Grand Prix, I was like, look, I was right. And then it was a sort of worse than Miller situation for looking back at the timing screen and going, oh. But yeah, that, like you say, it's the tire chewing as well. Yamaha is doing this magic thing of making problems it didn't previously had appear while not fixing the problems it also had. And yeah. You say the grace it has is it has signed Quartararo again. Okay, yes, the grace it mainly has is Honda is redefining what bad looks like for a manufacturer team at the moment.
Yeah.
Because I think if Honda wasn't doing that, we'd be looking at Yamaha going, what is going on?
Yeah, and we're
but
still
it is more
that.
Of a sense of Yamaha going somewhere in terms of, even if we're not seeing it yet, the amount of new stuff being talked about sounds absolutely enormous, like a team that has found its answers, it just hasn't managed to stick them on the bike yet. Is that fair?
I don't know. I'm not convinced, but maybe. I mean, Fabio Quartararo sounds convinced, but he's also got financial incentive to be convinced.
does rather fit the pattern of things Quartararo said. When he's not been furious, he's been optimistic, really, hasn't he? It hasn't been a middle ground over the Yamaha struggle years.
Yeah.
I think that one of the things that they are going to have to be careful of in the next bit of time is just they're coming up to a big management change, it sounds like, with Lynn Jarvis stepping down. And they're going to have to try and maintain the momentum of change into a new team leader as well. That's something to be aware of. I'm not saying that that's going to be an issue, but they've got someone at the minute in Lynn Jarvis who is quite a, I've said since day one that Lynn should have been the UK's Brexit negotiator because he's such a skilled politician. And this kind of European guy who speaks many languages and is fantastic in that role. And I think it would be easy to maybe lose a bit of that momentum, that method of working with the Japanese to actually get things that you want under a change in leadership. So that's another thing that they've got to keep an eye on.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So, Honda and Yamaha, Jack Miller and Augusto Fernandez. So far, our list, which I can't argue with, but our list is on a bit of a theme. Struggling people in the KTM brand and struggling Japanese manufacturers. So now I think we need to go off-piste a bit. Val, are you going to thrill me with your next pick?
Yeah, I've sort of got a couple of options, but let's go with another sort of cheaty entry. Wow, good job. Entry, which will be Miguel Oliveira or... both Trackhouse riders.
Ooh.
With Miguel Oliveira a 4 and Raul Fernandez a 2, I would say. So that's where I am. Oliveira's not really, by his own admission, just not clicking with the bike as well as he had with the 22. I think there were real flashes of real good performance on the 22 for Oliveira just through the injuries. You couldn't really get any continuity or see what it could actually lead to. And on the 24, there's just really not been so much yet. It's not been like terrible. He's not cast adrift, but it's, when you look at what Maverick Viñales was doing on that same bike at COTA, it's not the same league. Even if for Oliveira, his race result was made look worse by him being held up by Franco Morbidelli crash right ahead of him. But he was still just all weekend, not really in the same time code in terms of performance. Raul Fernandez is basically there with him, but Fernandez, of course, has the 2023 Aprilia rather than the 2024. And I think based on all the sort of the things we can compare, and as much as we can look at the two sets of results and try to estimate, you can probably put 4 or 5 or 6 tenths between the two specs of bikes, right? Or something at least. I think the 2024 Aprilia is better. I mean, looking at COTA, you have to account for the track changes and the evolution and all that. And the lap record was smashed by a second. But there is still, I think, a difference between specs and the fact that Raul Fernandez is close to Oliveira and the lap times he's been running, the race times. They suggest that, if you transport him to 2023, he's there or thereabout with the other Aprilias on that same bike. But obviously not in Viñales' league again, and he's not qualifying well still, I would say, and he's still making errors. So that's where the 2 for Fernandez comes from, and that's where the 4 for Oliveira for me comes from.
So I didn't have either of them on my list, but I completely get your point regarding Oliveira. I think Fernandez is in a safer position because he's younger, he's seen as the development rider by Aprilia, is the project that I work on. And I think that, in theory, he should be further ahead in the championship standings than Oliveira if it wasn't for technical problems to kick off the season in Qatar, where, that arguably cost him the opportunity for a really good result. Oliveira has not made the adaption very easily to the 24 bike, has he? Like, it has not went well. And you know, in a world where the factory bikes are so much better, and especially Vignale's is so much better, then yeah, I completely take your point, Val. He should be feeling the pressure right now, because we know that there are going to be hot prospects on the market for next year. We know that, as Davide Brivio told us on the podcast a few weeks ago, that they are very much in the market for whoever is available, which makes it very clear that, you know, Oliveira's seat is not a safe seat. He really needs to start being consistently in the top 10 and needs to get back to that, you know, occasional race winning or podium fighting position that we haven't seen him in what, over a year?
Yeah.
Really, since the opening round of last season.
Yeah. I genuinely don't hold any of last season against him, given what happens repeatedly, apart from the mistake that injured him to end it, which was his error. But otherwise, I think, I don't think it would be fair, but I think now it is fair game. And he, you know, he's clever. He knows it doesn't look so good right now. I think he seems to agree with Maverick Vinales' balance explanation. It's just, you know, look at Vinales and his suddenly balanced bike. If I get there, maybe I can do some magic of my own. Possible, but you have to get there, because there will be people in MotoGP who just saw Maverick Vinales do unspeakable things at Kota with the 24 Aprilia, and they'll go, oh, I'd like a work-spec Aprilia next year. That'd be interesting. I think I can do something special with it, especially if Aprilia happens to re-sign both Maverick Vinales and Aleix Espargaró, then the only route to a works Aprilia, well, it's Trackhouse. And right now, Oliveira is the Trackhouse rider who looks more expendable. I also would presume he's a bit more expensive, so that's not really coming across in the results right now. There's so much of the season still to go, obviously, but things will start to move. I mean, they already are behind the scenes.
Well, also,
so he needs to get a move on.
It's not just there's so much of the season left to go, though. Like, the last two weekends, Vinales has just been the greatest advert for how good a 2024 Aprilia can be. And it's okay to have a rider performance disparity when the bike's bad and one rider is wrestling it or has found enough affinity and the other one's got no confidence. I think that's in a different... other Honda riders who are made to look pointless by Marc Márquez, I can let that go and know they'll be fine somewhere else. The Pedro Acosta versus other KTM thing is in this sort of ballpark where the bike's clearly good. It's not like it's a rubbish bike that Acosta's achieving miracles on. He's achieving miracles for his inexperience, but the bike's clearly good. This Aprilia clearly has potential to be very good as well. And Oliveira just isn't really showing any of that yet. And I think MotoGP, particularly MotoGP about to be owned by Liberty Media, will want Trackhouse to be doing well. You know, this is an important team for Dorna. And its presence in the US market that Liberty has tapped so well for F1 and MotoGP is trying to get back into. It wants those bikes to be further up this grid. So I agree on Oliveira's vulnerability, absolutely. Raul Fernandez, just needs to do something now, really, for me, in the nicest possible way. You know, we talked about the difference between types of champion. He wasn't actually Moto2 champion, was he? He was just such an impressive runner-up.
He was runner-up to Remy Gardner, yeah.
In a sole Moto2 season, but what he was doing in Moto2 that season obviously famously made KTM yank him away from Yamaha's clutches and promote him, announcing it mid-session, not even just mid-season, and sacking its riders while they were out in practice to make way for him. He wasn't in Acosta territory for how big a superstar he was thought to be, but he was certainly above where Augusto Fernandez was seen to be. This is someone who pretty great things were expected of. And how many times have we seen anything in MotoGP from him remotely in that range of our kind of mid-2021 expectations? And we're now
in that range, nothing.
No, and we're now two and a bit years in, which suggests that just isn't translating, or, you know, can't translate at MotoGP level. So I know the circumstances when he was in KTM's MotoGP lineup weren't the best for him. I know there've been physical issues as well, but there needs to be a boom. There needs to be something that makes that August 2021 press release from KTM make complete sense after all, and make you go, oh yeah, that's why they did it.
But wouldn't it be irrational for Trackhouse to judge Fernandez on the rider that, you know, Raslan Razzoli and all the other people believed in and thought they saw, rather than the rider who looks pretty good, who they have now?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, ultimately, if this was Augusto Fernandez instead of Raul Fernandez, we'd have just shrugged and gone, yeah, all right.
That's a really interesting point, isn't it? Yeah.
I get what you're coming from completely, like 100%. Yeah. But it's an interesting situation to think of. I mean, because the first couple of years, it really wasn't working. Right now, it's at least, you know, given the bike spec discrepancy and all that, I see a viable MotoGP career rider here, at least, which is important, an important step for me. But obviously, the expectations were not that. I mean, he wasn't a Costa level hype, but he was not that far off. So,
no.
Yeah.
And the Costa's a once in a decade level of hype as well, and rightly so far. Simon, who is your final pick for somebody in big trouble heading to Jerez and beyond?
So my final pick, it is only a number one. It's in the lowest end of this. But it's sticking with the Aprilia rider theme. I would have said this is a complete 180 from a few weeks ago. A few weeks ago, I'd have said that Maverick Viñales needed to shape up or ship out, and he has shaped up. I think he's done enough to kind of keep himself in Aprilia going forward. I actually think it's now the other side of the garage. It's Aleix Espargaró that finds himself in a little bit more of a precarious situation. Aprilia aren't going to sack him. Right? They're not. They're just, that's not the relationship that those two, that the factory and the rider have. But I can increasingly see more and more pressure being put on him to take a test rider role for the future, given that, you know, he's now not performing to the same level of Viñales, and that there's the opportunity of getting some really, really big names secured for the future. And, you know, people like Marco Bezzecchi or Enea Bastianini are available, are potentially on the market. Hell, even Jorge Martin is potentially on the market for Aprilia going forwards. And I don't think there's enough. I don't want to say that Aprilia don't have enough loyalty to Aleix, but I think that they have a very clear, definite path for him to remain a part of the factory while not racing every weekend, that he himself has publicly said he wants to do at some point. I just think that if he doesn't start matching, or at least getting a bit closer to Maverick's results over the next few rounds, he's going to find himself in a position where he has less and less ability to choose which route his future path takes.
Yeah, I find that one hard to argue with as well. It's we're judging it to a degree on two weekends because Viñales has just transformed how he's perceived right now.
Yeah.
But rightly so, emphatically, he could have won four races out of four races across those two weekends without too many circumstances being different. So I get it. I think the thing for Aprilia now, though, is it's almost more about Viñales than Espargaró in terms of how you see Espargaró from here, because this is Maverick Viñales, so what's just happened could be it for the season. We might never see that Viñales again.
Oh, yes.
In which case,
oh, yes,
this conversation flips around again and the Aprilia's going, oh, what do we do? We know this is possible, but it might only be possible once every 5 years. Oh, this could be the start of the Viñales we see going forward, or we might get blips and ups and downs. But I think, to me, I can't put Espargaró in context till I see what Viñales we're getting over the next few races.
Yeah, I just want to see Barcelona. Like, Barcelona is the one that I think will give me a lot of answers as to what's going on and whether Viñales really has stolen half a march on Espargaró. Because, yeah, Espargaró doesn't really like Portimao or Cota very much. I mean, and that's the two rounds we got. And in Qatar, he was really fast. So I'm curious, just a bigger sample size I would like to see. And I know that MotoGP's silly season doesn't always allow for that. And maybe Aprilia is put in a situation where he just has to sign somebody now or they are off the market, in which case this is the sample size they judge on. And so we can't dismiss that. But as long as that's not the situation, I would really like to see a larger sample size. But obviously, like when your teammate is having that kind of weekend, their questions do exist. That's fair. I think that's fair.
Weirdly, in rider market terms, yay, back to the rider market, I feel like Aprilia is in a sort of 3/4 for the problem it's now facing going into these next few months, because it is now the manufacturer that needs to do something. No one's looking at Honda, who's any good right now. Yamaha's got its talisman, sort of. Ducati's got a billion riders. KTM has got its talisman and has a billion riders. Aprilia's lost out on Fabio Quartararo. There's a lot of other riders it could get, but and who will be looking at that bike going, oh, that does look good after all, even though they aren't going to pay me much more. It's going to have to make a move pretty soon, I feel. And all the time, its current riders are kind of giving it a slightly confusing picture that is sometimes fantastic. It's in a difficult spot.
I guess I might just have to wait and see who loses out in the Ducati shuffle, and see what they can do with that. Because I think there's been a lot of smoke over the Enea Bastianini interest, I think. And Enea Bastianini's had a solid start to the season, but he's not quite matching the edge of pace of Jorge Martin. And I don't know if the tracks have flattered him just a little bit. I'd like, again, this is another case where I'd really like to see a bigger sample size. Even though he's been pretty good, I wonder if he doesn't quite have this year the championship potential the way Jorge Martin or Pecco Bagnaia or even Marc Marquez have. But yeah, you know, if they can go get him, that's perfect. You did say, Matt, you did say Ducati had 5 million trillion riders, and that is accurate. We don't know how many bikes they'll have next year. That's still, you know, true. A little bit up in the air, which is also part of the reason why, actually, because I made way too many entries, obviously. I have, like, all of my remaining ones are Ducati riders, like, each of them. And I wonder how many of them could be options for Aprilia, but if they were options, they'd be support secondary options. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, then. I don't like going to the reserve list necessarily, but you can each chuck in one other one, but we're not going to debate it in full. You've got one sentence to make your case for why this other team or rider is in trouble. Val, you go first.
Okay. I'm Franco Morbidelli. Aww. 1 in performance, 4 in terms of the rider market. I think he's getting there in terms of pace. I think he's making up for the deficit that he started the season with, and he's catching up and learning. But I also think that if the size of the Ducati camp shrinks, then he's going to be in trouble. Although, actually, now that I think about it, Celestino Vietti not performing so well, maybe there is going to be always a safety in a VR46. So there's that. In which case, it's maybe a 1-2, in which case he's fine.
I mean, given that I said one sentence, you threw a lot of commas and semicolons into
that.
It was pretty succinct, pretty succinct. Simon, who's your just missing out one sentence justification?
Ducati, because I think they need to get the bike working a little bit better so that Pecco Bagnaia can be a bit more comfortable going forward, because right now he looks decidedly uncomfortable.
He does, doesn't he? Now this is the sort of thing for me. This is like a classic Jerez onwards. If this doesn't settle down, I feel like there were Casey Stoner failed title bid years where you got to Jerez thinking that things would kick on and then they didn't, and that was your sign that this wasn't going to happen. And I think we might be in that sort of territory with Pecco Bagnaia, even though we have 50 million trillion rounds for this all to shake out. So, listeners, thank you for joining us for this podcast of doom, looking at who is fighting for their future or fighting for respectability. We'll get onto positive territory and maybe even mention some race winners this time next week when we give you all our thoughts from the Spanish Grand Prix at Jerez. This is one with a Monday test afterwards. Sometimes, in the right circumstances, we hang on and wait for after the test of the podcast. I think, unless Simon is about to announce a massively strong reason why we should do that, like Yamaha's going to turn up with a 7-wheeler or something, I think we'll go for a Sunday night recording and get it to you as soon as possible post-race this time. Simon's nodding for you, no 7-wheelers. So, thank you for your time this week. We'll see you back in your ears after Jerez.
The Athletic.